insurance with some companies that turned out not to exist, but the Royal Bahamas, similar agents. I was wondering, and also I'm a long-term subscriber to the Economist, so I watch very Boy, I was curious what has happened with both the inclusion into the reinsurance market by various operators, the clearly illegal ones like Royal Bahamas and then some more shady ones, soaking off part of the market, and also the internal problems that Lloyd's has had and led to the, shall we say, a little bit greater policing that had to before. Has this restricted the ability of Lloyd's to operate in the market? Is this part of what we're seeing here?
The recent troubles in the insurance industry with fictitious insurance companies going bust and non-fictitious insurance going bust and a couple of syndicates with management of people seemingly lacking in honesty have far from making things difficult to gather underwriters. Made it, in fact, a lot easier because with this kind of illegal competition out of the way, the market becomes that much more stable. You can imagine what it's like when you have competitors in business, various people operate, being oblivious of any rulebook, taking risks that they have no responsibility for, and certainly have no funds for which to pay any claims. What I would like to say is that London, not only in the Lloyd's regulated body, is tightening up, but the Department of Trade that governs the running of insurance companies in London generally is also tightening up. It's not made very public, but they are improving the quality of the staff in their offices who supervise and audit and control the behavior of the insurance industry in London generally. Thing that perhaps I might suggest to the legislature here is that in addition to tort reform, you should look at your insurance department and give it the quality of staff and the finance to allow them time so that every single insurer who wishes to sell insurance in your state goes through an examination and monitoring process which should ensure that there are assets there to pay the claims and the policies issued by that insurance company. And further, the monitoring of brokers operating in Alaska should also take the same strict surveillance. It's all very well to ask brokers and others to put up bonds and funds in the state. This is no guarantee that the conduct or the insurance company underwriters is going to be any better. Sometimes they can find the money to put up the bonds because they know that ultimately, having worked the scam they have planned over the last year or two, they're going to pull out 10 times as much money and get away with it before anybody's discovered what they're doing. I know this is going to have to be talked before, but it would certainly help if you could eliminate these pirates and pirates.
Thank you, Representative Collins.
Thank you. I have a question that was generated by a statement that Mr. Kelly made, and I'll ask it to Mr. Libby. His statement, I don't know if it was facetious or not, was that we ought, if we're looking at limiting attorneys' contingency fees, then perhaps we ought to look at limiting defense fees. That was a question that I had thought of, and I'm wondering how that could be accomplished. It's easier in a sense that with a plaintiff bar because you know what the dollar amount is but on defense. How would you go about limiting defense or setting some limits on defense fees?
Thank you. I think we can provide in that regard to Representative Collins. And I think we can even predict the results of it to some extent, probably a lot more than the example of the contingent fee. The studies that were done 20 years ago when we were dealing with no-fault insurance and whether or not no-fault was good for the nation, good for Alaska, produced some very interesting statistics. They produced some hard data about where the insurance dollar was being paid and how the claims broke down with respect to payments made to claimants. And one thing that came out of those studies from the industry was that at that time, and that was, the study was done in 1964 and reported about 1966, so it would have to be upgraded to compensate for inflation since that time. But what was found was that of the claims actually paid above $10,000 in out-of-pocket loss, only 3% of the claims paid exceeded that figure. 97% were less than $10,000 in out-of-pocket costs. In addition, out-of-pocket cost was nearly the entire payment on a broad range of basis. That is, pain and suffering or non-economic damages really amounted to only about 1% of the premium dollar, as opposed to 52% that was out-of-pocket losses. So the real dollar being paid was in out-of-pocket losses. 97% of that was being paid to claims of less than $10,000. If we upgrade that to some realistic figure in today's world, that is, to account for inflation, and we propose that that figure is at about $50,000, very generously, then if we could deal better with claims up to $50,000, if the system could deal better with those claims, we could save an awful lot of money, because we're talking about 97% of the money actually paid out of the insurance premium to the claimant. The claims in that category would also entail roughly 50% of the defense cost. So if we can get at those 97% of the claims, we can get at 97% of that 50% of the insurance dollar that remains in the hands of the industry as defense costs. Now, how do we get at that 50% of the premium dollar? We get at it by shortening and economizing the litigation system. And we propose in that regard that the legislature consider as a real cost savings and as a real leverage on insurance premiums, consider committing those claims below $50,000, or up to $50,000, to an arbitration system. An arbitration system that does not afford the parties the expensive discovery, the benefit of delay, that gradually pushes the cost of defense higher and higher in each and every claim and collectively in the whole system. So that if we can get at those 97% of the claims, we can get at 50% of the premium dollar just in defense costs. To the extent that we lower the time involved in those claims, to the extent that we simplify the process, presenting the claims to arbitration, we get at that 50% of the policy dollar that goes to the defense attorney. Now, he gets the same amount per hour. We don't lower his per hour rate, which incidentally figures out on a balance to be about the same thing that the plaintiff's attorneys make. We don't change his rate per hour, but we change the amount he can put into a given claim prior to its payment, and therefore we lower the defense cost in that claim. Now, we can not only impact the cost of insurance by going to this system by a significant amount, we can also address the cost to the court system. Because personal injury claims as a group are approximately 20% of the overall litigation in our courts. That's not just in Alaska, but it's nationwide. And we can impact 97% of that 20% in terms of the cost of our court system in handling those claims. That's how we can get a defense cost.
Thank you. Mr. Hunter, do you have a comment?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Mr. Libby if we could get copies of that statistical data that you quoted for the record.
Yes, that statistical data was a report by the Department of Transportation to the President and Congress at the time when Congress was considering, as Mr. Hunter pointed out, whether it was desirable to implant no-fault on a nationwide basis in legislation into the American court system. And that that report was made to the Congress and to the President in 1971 by the Department of Transportation. I can also give you additional statistics or reports containing additional statistics by the industry itself that were inputted into the same litigation or legislation process.
Thank you. Mr. Hunter.
There are three ways to do it to limit to lower defense fees. One is to lower their hours. One is to lower their hourly fees, which is two. And three is to is possibly through insurance rate regulation. Regarding lowering hours, I mentioned that there are certain things like secrecy agreements where defendants sell the case only if the plaintiff agrees never to disclose evidence. In the case of other plaintiffs, that creates unnecessary work and forces the plaintiff's lawyers to continually reinvent the wheel, and there's and the same kinds of depositions are taken over and over and over again, and so on. Expanding the use of offensive collateral estoppel. Even when a court has held the product to be defective, each plaintiff injured by the same product must reprove that the product is defective. Again, this creates unnecessary delay and unnecessary work. It's much more efficient to allow prior holdings that a product is defective, you know, with given there'll be differences between the cases, but at least allow that as part of the evidence in a case. And transfer small cases out of the alternative system for use of arbitration or things like that. So that will lower hours. Regarding fees, it's just like capping a contingency fee. You can cap it at an hourly rate. If one is unconstitutional, so is the other. So if not, they're both good. Finally, insurance rate regulation might say, well, all right, insurance companies, you think you need 50 cents out of every lost dollar to defense, we'll give you 35. You figure out how to lower it.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions, and I apologize for not being here most of the afternoon, but I'm not sure. I hope I can get the answers, even if they've been dealt with. First of all, there was discussion earlier about money being set aside to cover claims at the time claim is filed. What happens after a claim is settled or adjudicated and paid, attorney's fees are paid, other costs are taken care of, and let's say there's a balance of X amount of money, hundreds of thousands or $300, what happens to that? I guess we have an answer.
It's released into surplus. It becomes the insurance company's money. For example, under current statutory accounting, insurance company, if I run into you and break your arm, my insurance company will go and see you and try to figure out that you're going to sue them and it's going to cost them $10,000 5 years from now. It'll immediately establish a $10,000 reserve. By the time 5 years roll around, obviously they have much more than $10,000 in their account when they run into the income line. They will have, let's say, $15,000 in the account. When the $10,000 is ultimately paid, then the $5,000 is released to surplus from the insurance company. They can have that money. Obviously, if instead you got $20,000, then they'd have to dip into surplus to get the extra $5,000. The General Accounting Office has recently proposed that for tax purposes only, that those reserves should be discounted. Because obviously, $10,000, if you're going to pay out a claim of $10,000 5 years from now, you don't need $10,000 to be deducted immediately from federal taxes. You can discount it for a fair rate of interest for the 5 years. And they are pushing that in
Congress. Can I assist you in that question?
I would do this.
We put reserves in when a loss does occur, and we have very good information to go on. So we do our best by comparing it with other losses of a similar type, which are recently accepted. We do our best to set the claim as quickly as possible, and it's not in our interest our image as sellers of insurance begins to deteriorate, and we can get a poor reputation if we don't pay up very promptly. And I myself learn to avoid the courts wherever possible, but because I'm delayed, it's a problem. Anyway, to get back to reserving, we reserve a claim, say, for $50,000, and I think that's what it's going to cost. But the evidence points to the probability that this particular instance client may not subsequently.
Excuse me, it goes into what?
It goes into our statistics. And these figures added to our paid losses and our premiums incurred and on assessing our rate of judgment for ensuing years. Now, it may be 12 months later we have another look at that claim and the lawyer acting for us there is becoming pessimistic. And I said, hey, I think we've got it wrong. We've got to reserve 75,000. Better increase that one up. We've got a very good case against us. Now, it may be that 4 years later we're still discussing this claim. Unfortunately, we aren't able to settle it out in court. And suddenly we discover the case is being settled in another state somewhere of a similar type where $500,000 has been awarded. And we've got this damn thing blowing up in our face. It's a possibility of $500,000 payment. And we decide that we may need to settle this.
Losses when it quit 11 years ago, that is what it had on the books, were under $100 million and they thought maybe they had a profit. But in the next 10 years, just the losses that were on the books and the new ones that came in, to the present, this is a year ago, the carrier has paid more than $355 million in claims and expenses. In 1984 alone, its 10th year after it stopped insuring, remember, for 10 years it's received no income on any of these claims or for any insurance. In 1984 alone, its 10th year after it stopped insuring, it paid out $30 million. It still has 1,300 known claims, that is, claims in the house that it must dispose of. And it still receives new claims. This is now 14 and a half years later. Still receives new claims at the rate of 200 a year. Now, this is why we reserve funds. We also have a reserve, which I'm surprised we haven't been accused of, that's called a reserve for incurred but not reported cases. This is a good conservative thing to do, is to reserve cases that you know you're going to get statistically from past experience. You reserve for them because you know they're going to come in. You have so-and-so many doctors, or so-and-so many airplanes, or so-and-so many steel plants. You know that they're going to generate at a certain level because they always have. You don't know about them yet, but you set a reserve for them, and you charge for them now because it's going to permit you to earn interest on the reserve that you've set up. And you're going to be a little more assured that at the time those claims come in, you're going to be able to pay them. Now, I don't think there's an insurance man in the world, including perhaps Mr. Hunter, that wouldn't expect that that's prudent management. And it's a good way to raise money without getting it out of premium. It's a good, sensible way to go.
Thank you, Connie. One last thought. Lawson brings up IBNR. I'm doing a study that shows that the incurred but not reported losses, that's the part that's
set up sort of over here as a guess at what might come out. Goes up at cycle bottom and down at cycle top. In other words, they sort of follow the same kind of. When the insurers get pessimistic about underwriting, they also get pessimistic about risk, about what they think they'll pay out in the future. There are many that go the other direction. Travelers of Southern California during the last cycle bottom had huge reserves. The doctors had to sue Travelers and got back $75 million in over reserves from medical malpractice in the state of California, from Southern California, last cycle bottom. Widely reported in the trade press. And the IBNR does vary up at cycle bottom, down at cycle top, and it's an extremely interesting phenomenon. You watch how it sort of goes in the opposite direction of where they are on the cycle, which of course reduces capacity when they're at cycle bottom, which gives them excess capacity when they're at cycle top. They do play some games with the IBNR.
Seems to be some disagreement.
There is. Not all of us do it well. But I think everybody tries to put it correctly. Also, that's a heavy oversimplification to put happen to Travelers. Much too complicated, but that's a simple, very oversimple response.
Is the price $75 million?
Yeah, that's too high, number one. Number two, it wasn't reserved. It was a fund that had been set aside by contract between Travelers and the doctors that was insured, which was to be given back. The only question was whether it was going to be given back sooner or whether it was going to be given back later. Travelers naturally wanted to hang on to it for a while until they found out how much they were really going to lose. They lost that, and they had to pay some of it back. They paid back, I think, about $11 million.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought I was going to sort of get the yes or no answer. let me try this one on for size. This morning we're showing curves of claims going up and fees doing this and various other things. And I was wondering to what extent recent settlements of asbestos claims were a factor in pushing claims curve up.
I didn't see were they paid for claims that were charged or incurred?
I don't know. I assume they were paid, but it was a curve that just sort of kept going down in sight.
I don't know what the charge
was. I was here at the point.
Okay.
You left here.
Can you answer that?
Senator, I don't know if you want me to.
Oh, I don't care who answers it.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, Dick had a chart, and I was just wondering, if this can be a chart aside, what effect has payment of asbestos claims and filing of these massive asbestos claims, what effect has that had on the insurance industry and claims paid out, the reserves established, rates, and whatever?
I think I can say with a great deal of confidence that in Alaska it has had absolutely no effect. Since I think I don't know of an asbestos case in Alaska. There may be a few, but there are not substantial numbers of them. Nationwide, I'm sure you're referring to the fact that there have been thousands and thousands, and I have to assume that if they're paying on those claims, which I'm assuming they are, that has to have some impact on what they're paying out. But in Alaska itself, it's not a small factor.
Mr. Chairman, we were told this morning that Alaska rates are not necessarily dependent on the history of claims in Alaska, but that we're affected by what happens nationally. And I believe the various curves that we saw were national rather than Alaska curves.
I can't say. I assume that whether it's some catastrophe in India or a catastrophe in Japan or a catastrophe in the United States through asbestos, that's going to have some impact on what
we all pay.
Yeah. Yeah,
I think Lloyd's has an answer.
Well, I don't have an answer, but in principle, the insurer has among its reserves certain free reserves, and when that is IBNR factors for 1960, 61, 62, 63, 64, 65, 66, 67, 68, and so on. Suddenly proved totally inadequate, and he has to put in a completely fresh IBNR for those years. An IBNR incurred but not reported factor. And furthermore, has to start paying out cash on years of account which he thought were dead. He has to start using up his free reserves, and this has a double effect. It reduces his ability to write fresh business. Or he has to call on his large syndicate, he can call upon his members to put up more money in order to cover this. Now, they put up more money by using some of the profit from other business, or they feed in more capital from their own pockets. But the net result is definite tightening up of underwriting attitudes by the underwriters in charge. It's as simple as that. The result is it doesn't just affect business in the United States. This asbestosis has caused their underwriting tightening up throughout the world.
I'm beginning to feel like this is going to be as difficult as taking a ball away from the Chicago Bears here trying to resolve this problem. But I think there's probably some solution in there, but it's just going to take time to find it. I guess I'm having some trouble here, and maybe Mr. Hunter is the person to ask the question of. And it seems to me that somebody has left this basement door open, and we've got somebody or something roaming around the countryside that's terrorizing our medical staff and our daycare centers and our school districts and fishing industry, and even taking on the municipalities. And it's difficult to detect. It kind of walks around, looks like us during the day, but at night it strikes, and trying to find the silver bullet, it seems to be very difficult to do so. And it's something, I guess, that you referred to as happened during the cyclical period. But how long is this this full moon lasting here as far as the industry is concerned?
It'll be over in 18 months.
It'll be over in 18 months.
Yep.
It's a very confident answer.
I've been through them over and over again. I can go back to 1900 on my charts. These things are absolutely predictable. I predicted EPA when I wrote them on September 1st, 1983. I said you had 2 years until the crisis really hit you. On pollution, on September 3, 1985, they called me to a crisis meeting. What do we do? I said, why didn't you read my memo 2 years ago? I gave you several options of ways to get ready to make sure that the availability was there, at least for the well-managed hazardous waste facilities. These things are not, in a macroeconomic sense, are not unpredictable at all. And I think within 18 months to 2 years, you'll start to see rates getting better.
Great. May I just ask a supplement? Regardless of what we do with respect to tort reform or regulation or anything?
That's correct. If you did nothing, it'll get fixed. The reason I'm here is I think there are ways to control the cycle for better regulation. And I listed in the testimony that I gave you, and I think there are ways to have a safety net of reinsurance. So that 1995 will happen again. Or maybe 94 or 80 or 96. I'll have to come all. I don't want to go to 30 states again in 3 months. I think we can work on it now and solve it. Work with the national and the state levels and solve it. And I think once it's solved, we don't have to go through this thing. We can control some of this cycle. Some of it is inevitable in a free economy. Cyclical patterns exist in other parts of the free economy. But it's also subject to control. The state of Texas saw this one coming and put and imposed the floor on rates. Said, wait a minute, we're heading to a cycle where we're gonna underpriced Texas, put in a floor. Very gutsy political thing to do. Because you know it meant businesses in Texas couldn't get the lower rates. Yet what happens now is Texas is getting all this all
high increases, because the cycle is too big for just Texas. It really is a much broader issue. And that's why places, I think the cycle thrives even in places like Ontario, even when the tort reform is there where what insurers say they want, still they have the same crisis, because the cycle is bigger than that. Now we need some kind of national as well as state controls. Reinsurance is a safety net, but there are ways also through floors, that are broader, and through ceiling, when rates get excessive, that regulators could impose and make the cycle under control if they have the courage.
Chairman, then how, maybe asking members of the industry, then, how do we protect the little guy that's out there, the one that's not going to be able to make it in that next 18 months, the one that is going to basically be the one there that goes down and there's nobody there to help him and there won't be anybody to help him there get back on his feet 20 months from now. But he's the one that's out there that's having to look at the higher interest rates along with the higher costs of the higher insurance rates and then the higher cost of operations between now and then, and he's just not going to survive. And how do we address that problem immediately?
Your question is right at the heart of your reason for the hearing. The trouble is, and I agree that in 18 months it's probably going to be over with as a crisis, and I hope that's right, because that's when our present reinsurance contract expires. We're very fortunate to have one lasting that long. However, when it is renewed, even if the crisis is over with, the crisis will be over with at today's present level rates, and that's much higher than they were 10 years ago. And next time we have a crisis, unless you do something to change the environment, it'll be at a next level higher rates. It'll just keep on going up and up and up until, as your insurance man this morning told you, you get tired of paying limitless amounts of money without any kind of oversight or any kind of prudence or any kind of supervision to the people who now earn their living in this matter. And I include in that insurance carriers, I include in that the bar association, both sides. I think you need to take a look at, see whether there are things that the legislature can do to modify the changes that the judge talked about a little earlier, and whether you can put those into place now so that 10 years from now, when we have another crisis, it won't wind up another 15 or 20 or 30 percentage points above extracting all that additional money out of everybody's pocket to pay for all these risks. I don't know that the things that you have in this proposal are going to work. They've been tried in California, they seem to be working, but we look back at 20 or 25 years and we tend to be kind of skeptical about everything until it really proves out by diminishing the losses. That's what's the key. If you can impose these changes upon the industry as it now exists, and you can make these modifications, perhaps this is step number one. You'll learn a lot more about where else you can go in diminishing these costs. At the same time, paying an adequate, proper, emotionally satisfying modicum of money to the people who are truly, honest to goodness, injured and require the money ought to get it, rather than a whole bunch of very, very fat, rich-making profits to some people that don't deserve it. And that happens both among patients and among the practitioners of both of insurance and of the law. I think that if you do that, if you start here, because nobody knows whether these are going to work, we know a little bit in California, maybe they do work. Certainly it's the best and first and most magnitudinous attempt that's been made so far to make some control. You're not going to do it by putting some more controls on the insurance industry, which is ridiculous. They're already the most supervised industry in Seamus Hickman, with the possible exception of medicine and banking. So I think that's what you ought to do. You ought to try to enact it.
Thing, Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up there. Earlier there was a comment made that there was some correspondence with Lloyd's that if we didn't have tort reform that Lloyd's was pulling out of the state. Is that right?
I read a quote from LaBeouf Lamb, the Lloyd's counsel, to that effect. I can give it to you again.
Oh, no, that's fine. I'm just wondering.
It was to that effect, yes.
I'm just wondering there if Mr. Caldsworth had a response to that. I don't...
No, I think Jeffrey Johnson there was simply saying that there's something is down in Alaska. Actually, it's going to be for the Lloyd's market like a tortoise or a snail. It's a heavy blow on its shell. It simply pulls its head and its horns. wasn't a threat by Lloyd's at all. What he was just saying, it's like night following day. That's the way it's going to go. I, for one, am not going to desert Alaska just because there isn't a talk before, but I should certainly keep a close eye on the working for the policies we issue and the leading to charge, and be more selective as to the people who we are prepared to charge.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just one more comment and I'm finished. There was another comment made that there was an exodus of insurance companies from the state of Alaska, and another one there that there's been an increase of insurance companies, and not to put the director of the state insurance on the spot here, but maybe if you could just give us some indication as to what the insurance business climate is like in the state.
Thank you. For those of you who don't know, I am John George, the director of insurance. All of those statements are true. We have gotten a lot of new insurance companies who have applied for certificates of authority to do business in the state. Some of those companies are actually writing business, and others only have the capability of writing when and if they decide to do that. We've had other companies who have not turned in their certificate of authority, but have declined to write either specific lines of insurance or have declined to write any insurance at all. So they've left the state to the extent that they aren't writing insurance here anymore, but they are still an admitted company and get counted on the list of companies eligible to write insurance here. So all of those statements are true. With the exception of those companies that are no longer with us, Ideal Mutual, Transit Casualty, Carriers, Union Indemnity, those companies are insolvent. They're out. And quite frankly, we've been fairly successful in predicting which companies those would be and have negotiated agreements with them to stop writing business long before they actually became insolvent. In fact, the Alaska policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One more question, and that leads to if a company is insolvent or gets to that point there where it is insolvent and it has claims against it and it's had money or its reserve set aside for certain claims, what happens on that, a situation like that? The person there that is the victim.
Okay. Several things happen in an insurance company insolvency that are different than a general bankruptcy. For one, an insurance company doesn't go bankrupt. They are put into receivership, supervision, or liquidation by the insurance department of the home state. So let's take the Mission Insurance Company in California. The California Insurance Department took over that company. They can supervise the company and essentially allow them to do business under supervision of the department. They can go in and try to rehabilitate the company and actually run the company, or if all of that fails, they can liquidate the company and spread the assets out as they can. Now, in the case of an admitted insurer doing business in Alaska, but they're off somewhere else and go broke, we have a guarantee association that will pick up the losses. Means that all of the other companies writing that particular line of insurance will pick up the losses for the insolvent company, with some exceptions. There are several lines that are excluded from coverage under the Guarantee Act. Security, marine, aircraft, title insurance, a few others. We have a Life Insurance Guarantee Act bill, your committee, that would provide that same type of benefit for life insurance companies if it were passed. So if the Mission Insurance Company becomes insolvent, they were a major workman's comp carrier in Alaska, all of the other companies that write workman's compensation in Alaska will end up paying the losses of the Mission Insurance Company.
Thank you.
Representative Copeland.
There has been a large area of insurance that has not been mentioned, other areas of economic activity in the state. Some of the professions and construction generally, it was the usual procedure in the past, a decade or more ago, for requirements in statute or otherwise, a bond, a performance bond, to be posted company didn't post its own assets against the bond. It essentially purchased a bond, which, as I understand, is a sort of form of term insurance. In other words, it cannot last a 20-year roof on a flat surface bond for that 20-year period. And one of the reasons that we got away from it was that it was felt that it was too onerous, this, purchase of a 20-year bond for a roof, and limited competition by restricting it to those companies who could, in fact, post a large bond, and that we've gotten into various forms of insurance, the premiums of which are smaller, errors and omissions, and the like. Would it be reasonable in those areas to return to the requirement for bonding rather than to allow this sort of interminable insurance thing? What kind of solutions are in this area? I'm thinking of people who haven't been here to complain, but I know that this is a problem.
I assume that you're referring to our deposit regulation that was adopted by Dick Block when he was the director and was repealed by Ken Moore when he was the director. There were a lot of pros and cons about that. The insurance industry, of course, didn't like having to post money specifically for Alaska claims. And I suppose the reason that we finally repealed that was that there wasn't enough money in that deposit to cover the losses if the company became insolvent. And so it was kind of a false security. There are a lot of companies that don't go broke, and they have to provide the same deposit as the ones that do. The ones that do go broke don't have enough deposit to really make a lot of difference. There are certainly arguments both directions on that. It's not.
I was referring to the insurance company bonds, Alaska bond, but the
surplus lines broker bonds?
Yeah, essentially they're broker bonds. Architects used to do it on buildings. Construction companies post their bonds and surveys. Land surveyors and the like would purchase the bond. Now they currently, and the complaint then was it cost too much and that it limited competition. In other words, people could not get into the construction business because it cost so much to post the bond. We went into see the ability to purchase insurance, which was a continuing coverage. Now we hear that they're not able to continue the insurance because the liability continues, whereas the bond is for a certain period of time if they only want to post the bond.
An interesting thing. It depends on whose ox is being gored, as an example. The
right.
Municipality of Anchorage is largely uninsured because insurance was too expensive, and, allegedly because there were lots of claims floating around against municipalities, maybe not against Anchorage, but against others, and so they picked it up for that. But Anchorage is the first to sue their architect for $6 million on the library because that guy didn't design it right and it's going to be late and whatever. So now there probably won't be any architect's insurance because there's been all these big claims, witness the one in Anchorage, Alaska. And so they dry up that market and then they complain that they can't hire an architect because the architects can't get the insurance. And so, it just goes round and round. For a contractor, for instance, the state requires for registration of a contractor. It's not really licensing per se because there's no requirements other than you have a bond. You go in and register and post a bond. The bonding companies traditionally have been used as the underwriters of the contractor, the one that goes out and says, well, this guy may not be able to perform because he doesn't have a track record, he doesn't really have any assets, he hasn't ever done this before, we're not going to write the bond. Well, because they couldn't get the bond, someone came in and said, well, let's let them post a certificate of deposit. So now anyone with the price of the certificate of deposit can go in and sign up and be a contractor. You don't have much public protection when you do that. The reason the bonding companies don't want to write the contractor bond is because the guy doesn't have experience and they have to back up his performance on the job and they don't believe that he's a good candidate to perform. So bonding is tough. No fun.
There may be options. Some of the federal agencies require insurance in certain circumstances. You give options like letters of credit, bonds, or insurance. They have to meet certain quality criteria in order to get some money there, in fact.
why you can't close that gap for us.
Well, you also confess that the way it works in the London market is that an insurer, you know, someone wants to buy insurance over here, goes to a broker, instead of broker in Anchorage, and there's a broker in Anchorage, and then goes to a broker in the London market and describes the coverage that he and the broker in the London market, and then goes to an insurance company or a syndicate in the Lloyd's market.
Effect on the don't know yet, can't know yet, how effective it's going to be. I have some great artists.
Please don't let us stop you, and for heaven's sake, don't take away anyone's rights. I know Mr. Hunter is only too keen to think that he's just doing this. We don't want to take away anybody's rights. We just want to stop the middleman from feeding off too much benefit. It should go to the benefits.
Is the middleman a crime?
Well, I'd like to speak to that remark, if I may. I, as a trial lawyer, having nearly 25 years of experience here in Anchorage, I have seen the cost of delivery of payment in the claim system escalate. It's getting higher and higher. The amount of defense effort is getting more and more intense, and that costs money. And the time between filing a claim and getting it to the jury is longer and longer, and that means money. If we could get into that 97% of 50% of premium dollars goes to defense costs through some system of simplification and arbitration that will cut those costs, we won't have to wait 10 years to see a reflection in the premium dollar, because we're talking a significant, a meaningful part of the premium dollar. And that's where reform should start. It's embarrassing to me as a trial lawyer, probably to the defense bar, certainly to the public and to the legislature, that it costs so much to operate this system, that it takes so much resource to operate this compensation system. And if we can get to that large a body of the overall civil personal injury litigation and do something about it, then we're going to see some results, not 10 years from now, but in the next year or two. Because otherwise there are going to be exorbitant profits made by insurance companies.
I think that you'll see some lawyer bashing during these proceedings. Representative Collins?
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Libby. What percentage of the cases that you have in your office are 50%, I mean, 50,000 are worth 50,000 or less?
My office, I think, Representative Collins, would be atypical of general office. I've been in personal injury work for about 20 years. I have a great deal of discretion over what I take and what I don't take. And though I still take a number of small claims, it's almost, you might say, pro bono. It's as a service to the community that we take them. But the breakdown in my office would probably be fairly 60%, maybe 60 to 70% are less than $50,000. In most practices, that percentage would be a lot higher.
Say that, Mr. Chairman, we don't have any choice over large claims or small claims. We have to give each one the same benefit of our expertise, regardless of the size.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to say something about arbitration, and I hope that no one will build in on it any real hope for cutting costs. The preeminent experimenter and with arbitration. The person, the group with the biggest experience with it is Kaiser in California. They have it as part of their contract. They have done probably more of it than any other single entity that I can think of. We've talked to them about it, asked them and talked to some of their attorneys to help them with it, asked them what the results are, and it does not save any money. The amount of costs that go out in the payment of analysts, the general costs remain about the same. As to how the orders come out, they said also there's no discernible difference. If they lose a lot of them, they shouldn't lose, and they win some, they shouldn't win. And they say the costs, they think, even out of approximately where they are anyhow. I know for years arbitration has been held up as one of the possible ways of getting away from this onerous court system, etc. The court system is not all bad. It's got a lot of safeguards in it, which most people are well advised not to give up with an arbitration contract. Now, there are times, of course, when that's perfectly reasonable, and there are minimal cases where this doesn't apply. But over the long haul, there's been a long haul with Kaiser, they have not saved any money.
I would just point out to the representative that arbitration is one of the planks in the tort reformers' present platform. Why it's in there, I don't know. It isn't intended to save insurance dollars. But I would also point out that from the industry's own literature, Insurance Week, I don't have the particular date of this publication. Or is it Well, I can put the exhibit in evidence. Anyway, it's a page from Insurance Week, very recently, that comments on the rising cost of defense in claims. Defense costs will be approximately 50% of payment paid on these claims. Hess, the speaker, pointed out that by including defense costs as part of the aggregate limit, not the occurrence limit, ISO hopes to reduce the growing, staggering expense, pointing out that in 1970, expenses were only about 25% of losses. They're currently 50% of losses. So while the contingent fee has risen as a function of the size of claims and the effect of inflation on claims, defense costs have risen 25% since 1970 as a proportion of the overall loss total. It's a serious matter. It's seriously impacting the cost of insurance. It's got to be addressed. I believe that arbitration is a good first step, a step in the right direction. If that's not the final answer, then the cost of defending these claims and the cost of processing these claims has to be studied fully. But we're not talking peanuts there. We're not talking saving something from a non-economic loss that really impacts the insurance dollar by only 1 or 2%. We're talking about something that impacts the insurance dollar by 50% of every dollar paid for premiums. And it's got to be addressed.
Thank you. But just a question that I have is kind of a follow-up. The defense costs are related to the amount of suits brought against the insurance companies by plaintiffs' attorneys. Interrelated there.
Nobody can argue with that. I can simply say that there are two considerations. One is that lawyers really don't make lawsuits unless you're talking about legal malpractice lawsuits. They simply listen to the people that come into them, analyze the claims, and bring those which they think they can defend in ultimately in court. And secondly, if you're in a business where your income is tied completely to the success you have on your claim, there is a built-in screen against those claims that appear superficially to be frivolous or to be unfounded or to be too expensive for the system. You simply can't take those claims and the system weeds them up.
Representative Copeland.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, it seems to me, not in the current discussion, but in our dealing with other questions that resulted in large-scale liability and large-scale insurance payments and claims. Asbestos is one, some of the hazardous waste, some of the toxic cases. Where the really large holdings of liability were, those cases were ultimately settled in federal court. Is that not true?
Yeah.
Then how are we going to settle these problems by changing state law? I think Mr. Charlesworth started off by saying that what lawyers would like to see is a uniform system nationally. Here we have 50 different jurisdictions, even each with its own system law and an unpredictable mix of findings that they all ultimately end up on the federal
law. It's a small percentage that actually end up in federal court.
I mean the...
Some of the big ones end up in thank goodness we have a legal system in this country that evolves. We had set standards saying let's freeze the system at 1940 levels. You wouldn't pay any asbestos claims. Then you have a lot of victims who are really hurt, and you would have a lot of punishments that deserve to be punished, like the Ford Pinto and those kinds of deals that wouldn't be punished. So one of the great powers is I travel around the world and see London's system. Sweden and Africa and other places is this dynamic system we have. It doesn't change overnight. It's a kind of leaping step function. But it evolves very slowly, almost glacially, in a direction that
really the public wants, and it goes up and down, ebbs and flows. But it's powerful. That's why I think, you know, messing around with it, something, maybe you can't even mess around with it, maybe there will be escapes into the federal courts, and maybe there will be other judges overruling new laws and so on, and maybe the power of the people to gain the kinds of recompense they think is right as they judge it individually in these small forums will still override all the legislation and whatnot that we do, and maybe in some sense we're irrelevant to that. But I think that's great. I think it's a power of this country. It's amazing. I have friends in Europe. They say, boy, you don't get hurt here. Of course, they have socialized medicine and so on, which we don't have. I mean, if we really want to institute the British system, we'd rather also bring in socialized medicine, because that backs up some of the lower standards, obviously. We don't have that. So if you take away rights to sue, you don't have the socialized medicine to go to. End up probably a ward of the state. So there's a lot of reasons why I think it's a little beyond the legislation. I think, not because of just the escape from the federal courts, but just because I think the power of the people to ultimately see fairness will continue.
Thank you. If there are no further questions, I'd like to thank our panelists today and note that we'll see all of you tomorrow in Juneau. Latest word we had was that we're flying into Juneau. Also, I'd like to ask for anyone here who, in case there's someone who won't be able to testify on the record at some later date, would anyone like to testify now? Thank you. If not, the meeting is adjourned.